Inviting me, and it's a particular pleasure to follow you, in part because I'm going to be talking about ageism in the UK, but also you mentioned Sir Michael Marmot, who's actually the head of the department that I work in, so that will give you a bit of an idea of where I'm coming from. I was a bit embarrassed to come here and talk about this, especially after the sessions that I've been to already. And then I thought, actually, I'm going to be really bullish about this, because we're not supposed to have inequalities. Every citizen of the UK who pays their taxes has an equal right to healthcare according to need. And so it's our job to critically evaluate that and to nuzzle and push and nudge the policymakers if we find that it's not. So these are the four questions that I'm going to look at today, and I must stress that I am looking at it in the UK context, because I can see that the second question, in what circumstances are healthcare inequalities most likely to occur, is a bit funny for Americans, because we all know the circumstances, but I'm going to look specifically in the UK what those circumstances are. People started to think about this with Julian Tudor Hart, who is one of the great heroes of the public health movement in the UK. He's a GP who works in the Welsh mining valleys, and his experiences of working there led him to write an article in The Lancet in 1971 where he coined this phrase, the inverse care law, and where he said that the availability of good medical care tends to vary inversely with the need for it. And when he wrote this, it really resonated. He wrote it based on his experience rather than on the basis of evidence. But in the intervening years, there's been an absolute plethora of research that has shown that we do indeed in the UK have a problem. And this, I suppose, culminated, if you like, in our Chief Medical Officer's report in 2006, where he cited evidence of both over and underuse of treatments in the UK and in most other countries. And I would say that the emphasis in the UK is more on underuse than on overuse, whereas it's obviously the flip side in the US. But he at that time picked up in issues around clinician judgment, around patient socioeconomic circumstances, around patient empowerment, and around historical resource allocation around the country. And we can find healthcare inequalities at all stages of the healthcare pathway. And we've done work at all of these stages. So right up at the top in bowel cancer screening, it's a new screening program in the UK, and the social gradient there varies from 60 to about 35% in uptake by socioeconomic status. We can find it in primary care. Now, I've always had the impression that primary care is a bit of a nirvana in the US, and Barbara Starfield has written very compellingly about the importance of primary care. I'm a little more sanguine about it in the UK, because GPs are gatekeepers, and that is what they do. So they can keep people out as well as let people in, and it might not always be the most appropriate decision. And one of the studies that I'll talk about in a minute is about this interface between primary and secondary care and the sorts of people and conditions that get through that interface, that gatekeeper stage. And then we have lots of evidence of inequalities in secondary care investigations and in secondary care treatment. Now, the problem with a huge amount of the research is that it's very cross-sectional in nature. So it will say, for example, there are inequalities in the use of diagnostic interventions or in therapeutic interventions. The problem is, though, that it's difficult to draw conclusions by doing this sort of snapshot cross-sectional research as to where these inequalities actually are occurring. So when I first got interested in this work in the 90s, I read a lot of American literature on revascularization, and it was on gender differences in revascularization, and there was a lot of literature about how women were getting less interventions than men. And when we actually looked into it, what we found was that the rate-limiting step, if you like, was angiography, so an invasive diagnostic procedure. And that what we found was is that amongst the women who received angiography, they went on to receive revascularization, the therapeutic intervention, the heart bypass surgery. And so it's really important to look throughout the entire pathway of care in order to find out what is the actual point at which inequalities are occurring. Because if we don't do that, then we don't know where to place the policy emphasis, where to change things. And a good example in the UK of this is with our issue around cancer survival rates. Because in the UK, it became very common headline news, splashed all over our papers, and quite right, that actually our cancer survival rates were not as good as those in other European countries. And not only that, we have real problems with our deprivation gap between socioeconomic groups. So, for example, the deprivation gap at this time for colon cancer was 7% between affluent and deprived groups. That was a widening gap. Other cancers, lung cancer, breast cancer, the gap was remaining static over time. So this created a huge concern in the UK. Why were we doing worse than other countries? So what happened? The New Labour government did a massive reorganisation of our cancer care, and much of the focus of that was on secondary and tertiary care. And what happened was is that patients went through a pathway of going via their GP, limits on the amount of time that they should wait, to cancer units, and then if they needed it, to more specialised cancer centres. And there were whole networks, set up. I'm very pleased to say that just 5 years after the launch of the plan, we did see better access, shorter waits, improved treatment, and improved survival. But we still have this problem that our cancer mortality is still still worse, particularly for older people compared to Europe. We still have the inequality gap, particularly for more socially disadvantaged people. And we still have the problem that patients are diagnosed at a later stage than they are in other countries. And the poorer survival was noted to be associated with both more severe disease at presentation and under treatment. So we decided we'd have a look at this because, you know, I'm thinking, okay, pathways to care, where is it that this gap, we've done this wonderful reorganisation of secondary care, so what's happening? Did we look not at the wrong stage, but did we miss a trick? Should we have focused a little bit higher up? So all we did, very simple, was use routinely available data to actually have a look at the pathways to care. And we looked at our routine, they're called hospital episode statistics, to look at over 500,000 patients admitted over the time frame 1999 to 2006. And we wanted to see that if we were really fulfilling the cancer plan, there should be a drop in the number of patients who come in via emergency care, and there should have been over time a trend for more and more patients to be accessing care through the elective route because they should be getting this pre-planned care. But what we actually saw was a pretty mixed picture. For breast cancer, we did see a downward trend over time in emergency admissions. But there's huge proportions, really shocking proportions. We looked at the three most common cancers, lung, colorectal, and breast. Over half lung cancer patients were still being admitted as emergencies, and that trend actually increased over time. For colorectal cancer, a third of our admissions is emergency admissions, no improvement over time. And guess what? People from deprived areas, older people and women were more likely to be admitted as emergencies. These are just a couple of examples, loads of data in the British Medical, the BMJ paper, but I've just picked out a few examples. So look at that odds of emergency admission for the least deprived, odds of 0.3 if you're 0.63 if you're affluent. And for the elderly, you're more than three times as likely to be admitted as an emergency if you're 80 to 89 versus if you're in your 50 to 59 year age group. And there were some improvements in the disparities for age groups, but not for people living in deprived areas over time. And then this fed through to treatments. So people from deprived areas were less likely to receive preferred procedures. And by that I mean for people with colorectal cancer, the preferred procedure is an anterior resection because it joins up two pieces of the bowel. The less preferred procedure, the abdominoperineal resection, you end up with a stoma. Not so pleasant. And so AR, anterior resection, is the preferred procedure, just like breast-conserving surgery, which I've given the acronym BCS for, is preferred in appropriate sorts of breast cancer tumour. It does depend on its position and size, of course. But again, look at those figures, and remember what we're talking about, big numbers here, that people living in the least deprived areas were more likely to get those procedures than those living in more deprived areas. We think that men are less likely to undergo anterior resection for anatomical reasons, but the lung cancer resection can't explain what's going on there. And to pick up on Cheryl's point, and in fact through a theme of this presentation, older people were less likely to receive the preferred procedures. So despite the implementation of the cancer plan, and this is real implementation, it wasn't just nodding at the problem, it was a real reorganisation, we still have problems in people getting into care. And what we think is happening is that there are delays in getting into care, and then as a result of that, they're not in a position to receive those preferred procedures. And so that's an example of how we have to look at the entire pathway. And we are now looking more at that, and we've got funding to do that. The government agree that we need to look at that. And the two areas that we're looking at are what's happening in the community, what's happening in the public recognition of cancer symptoms, and how can we actually shift the level of recognition so that people can understand more what are symptoms that actually need to be taken note of, but also what's happening in primary care. This is something that I'm particularly interested in, and we're going to be doing more work on, is what sort of patients are GPs referring, and what sort aren't they, and what drives them to do that. So I understand that if you don't have health insurance, that's a very important circumstance where health inequalities are likely to occur. But as I've said, in our system, that is not the case. So I wanted to know, what's happening? What can we actually encapsulate some criteria that determine whether people are likely to get into the system? Because as I said, the GP is the gatekeeper. The GP decides, and only the GP, whether a patient should move through into the secondary care system. It works very well, but we need to really be sure that it is working very well all of the time for all of the people, and not just some of the time for some of the people. So we used a large data set of 326 practices. The time period here is 2001 to 2007. And we didn't just pick out of the blue three symptoms. We looked at the most common symptoms that are referred, and then we teased it down according to certain questions. So we had to pick a symptom for which we could say, oh yes, this symptom needs to be referred, or there is a lack of certainty about whether it does. So for example, poor vision is a symptom that is often referred, but poor vision may be due to cataracts, which you need to refer a patient for, or it might be due to refractive issues which you don't need to refer into secondary care for. So we had to pick symptoms where we could say we would expect in certain circumstances these patients to be referred. And we wanted to look across medicine and surgery, and we wanted to also have, if you like, a reference condition where we would expect that if you turn up with that symptom, gold standard is you be referred. And for that, we had postmenopausal bleeding. Then we wanted to look at symptoms where there is certainty around who you should refer versus there where there isn't. So we looked at hip pain because our national guidelines actually state that it isn't clear whether people should be referred with hip pain or not. There aren't good, clear, explicit criteria that say, yes, these people should. Dyspepsia is an interesting one. Under the age of 55, there isn't any guidance as to whether people should be referred or not. But for people with severe persistent dyspepsia over the age of 55, it is recommended in our national guidance that people should be referred. So we wanted to see, is there a difference? If a condition is potentially life-threatening and if there's explicit guidance, does that make a difference as to whether people are referred or not? And guess what? older people again, regardless, so even in that, even in the condition, postmenopausal bleeding, they were less likely to be referred. And I think all of the points that Shell was making about the reasons why this might be happening, I think we have to think about all of those reasons as to what's going on in our UK tax-funded system where these people have been paying their taxes all their lives. Women are less likely to be referred for hip pain, and more deprived patients for hip pain and dyspepsia, again, less likely to be referred. Dyspepsia only for those aged less than 55, so only where the evidence is not clear as to whether they should be deprived or not, i.e. where there is uncertainty, where there is room for judgment outside guidance, where there is room to really think about what is perhaps best for the patients, what the patients think is best for them. That's where there is diversity in the likelihood of referral. We might be able to put this down to patient preference, but if we can, then I really want to unravel as to what's going on there around patient preference, and I'll talk about that a bit later. So, do they matter? Well, as it was pointed out to me just before this session, we're having a very difficult time in the UK, as you are in the US at the moment, with funding cuts. And although we're told in the UK that the National Health Service is not being cut, it is being cut in real terms. And a real discourse is all around fairness. We keep being told that everything is going to be done in a fair way. And although different sides of the political spectrum will have different definitions of fairness, there's still a real drive in the UK about the notion of fairness and that it should be adhered to. And the notion of fairness upon which the NHS is built is one around availability of care on the basis of need. So that means that we can argue that if certain groups do not benefit from an intervention, they have less need for it. So I wanted to actually look more at that and to see if where there were inequalities, if that could be explained by variations in outcome. Because if they can be justified by variations in outcome, then it might be unequal, but it may not be unfair. So to do that, we looked again in primary care, getting a bit of a theme here, and looking at stroke survival, because it's so common. Again, big national survey. This was done between 1995 and 2005. And here, we did not find differences by socioeconomic group, but we did find differences by age. First of all, overall, we had, across the piece, we had real under-treatment issues. Only a quarter of men and 20% of women were actually getting the secondary prevention that they needed. But older people were less than half as likely to get it, and that was totally down to the likelihood of them receiving statins, not the likelihood of them receiving the much cheaper antihypertensive or antithrombotics. And does it matter? Yep, it mattered. We excluded the first 30 days after diagnosis of stroke because I was interested in what happened in primary care. And for 30-day survivors, 50% reduction in mortality risk. And this, thank you. And this meant that for people on treatment, 5.7% mortality versus 11% mortality for those not on treatment. In absolute differences, that is of much more importance to older people. 50 to 59-year-olds, the mortality drop went from 3.9% to 2%. 80 to 89-year-olds, it went from 20% to 10.9%. So in terms of absolute differences, far more important for elderly people than for younger people. And we're talking about 50,000 stroke patients a year over the age of 75. So no small beer. English phrase, I shouldn't have said that. Undertreatment of older people cannot be justified in terms of variations in effectiveness because older people are as likely to benefit from treatment as younger people. So, healthcare inequalities matter because they're unfair and they undermine the capacity of the NHS to remain true to its core values. They may not be justified in terms of treatment effectiveness. And unlike the case that you brought up, you said we don't have any regulation. We do have regulation now in the UK. It's just been brought in, and it's called the UK Equality Act. I'm going to run through the rest of it now because I've got about 3 minutes, but these are all really big issues in both the UK and the US. Should we tackle the inverse care law by state intervention or individual freedom? And should we address the gap or the gradient? I think the gradient is what Dr. Cornel West was talking about yesterday. We've been slowly shifting towards individual freedom rather than state intervention. Even in our new Labour government, 2004 produced a document that was very mixed up document in terms of its philosophical underpinnings, but it was shifting towards informed choice. At the same time, in that particular document, there was recognition that choices are constrained, and the Secretary of State at the time himself quoted from Marx and talked about people having choices but not in circumstances of their own choosing, because even he recognised that actually your choices are determined by your expectations and they can differ by your perceptions of risk and benefit and by the way information is framed. I don't need to tell this audience that simply if I give someone an absolute risk or a relative risk for the same difference, it actually sounds different depending on what comes through. This is our new Secretary of State for Health, who is a Conservative in the coalition government, and he's very, very clearly pinned his colours to the mast. But why he says this widely used phrase, no decision about me, without me, he's absolutely making no recognition for the fact that when you're making these informed decisions, they may actually reflect inaccurate perceptions about care effectiveness availability. And while more power is all the time being put into the hands of our primary care practitioners, we also know that when they're providing information, that information is socially patterned. And some other work that we've done is that even when there's evidence, if it overrides their own opinion, they will give different evidence, they will give a different opinion. The gap and the gradient, I'll really rush here. What should we address? I think that where we've got really complex interventions, we can only address the gap, partly because they're just too big and too complex to do in a population-based way. But that is going to mean that people are left out, and I think that's a really important issue, because where do you draw the line? So is the answer the gradient? Well, Cesar Victoria, in his work in Brazil, pointed out that the problem with universal access to improved interventions can actually give you, at least in the short term, adverse consequences where you actually increase the gap because more affluent people take it up first. However, we've shown that in two public health interventions in the UK, for right or for wrong, these interventions, we found that if you really work hard at putting these universal interventions into deprived communities, the uptake and the outputs will actually be beneficial in those communities and more beneficial than in less disadvantaged communities. So I don't think that you necessarily do increase the inequality gap by universal interventions. You all know about this, except that you turn it around and you call it the nurse-family partnership. We have borrowed from you, and we are, at the moment, actually increasing our family nurse partnership program in the UK, which is a good thing. The problem is that it does leave people out, and it also means that professionals go to the more prestigious jobs. And what worries me is that there's people all the way up that gradient who need intervention, and I don't want them to get left out. So I think that the things we have to think about are measurement all the way through the pathway, our routine measurement, our measuring outcomes, and of evaluating. And when we evaluate, I am a physician, but I'm afraid we're not kings. We are also lay people, and we make lay judgments, and they may not be right. And I think we have to be as critically evaluated as the population who we are judging. Thank you.